Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hello there, thanks for joining us. No politics tonight, I promise. Well, at least for the first couple of hours. Towards the end of the evening, if you've got something really burdensome on your chest and you want to get it out about what happened and how it happened and why it happened and what you think went wrong or right, well, perhaps you're welcome to do it. But do hold fire for a couple of hours. Today, around the country, thousands of people would have been to church. Many thousands of others would have been out supporting their families at community sporting events or something similar. Yet compared to previous generations, we've become a pretty passive lot. Television and easy entertainment have helped transform us into something of an individually tailored spectator culture. The world is available on my iPod. It may also have something to do with commerce and the professionalisation of things like football. Remember the days when AFL clubs were owned by the tribal loyalty of local communities? If you were a kid at Collingwood in the 1950s, you could even sneak into the rooms at half-time or after the match. In rugby league states, that community ethos lasted somewhat longer, but it's fast on the wane. For over 100 years, church agencies like Vinnie's and the Salvos have relied on an activist base of core members delivering their services. It's been central to who they are. Being a member of Vinnie's was not just about what you did as a community service, but how that service helped transform you as a person. The Salvos didn't want members sitting in congregations, they were soldiers, because being a soldier, being active in service, was essential to your spiritual growth. Well, over the past half century, more and more of the community care and service provided by groups like the Society of St. Vincent de Paul and the Salvation Army have passed into the hands of professionals and increasingly into tightly managed contracts for service delivery. Previously on this program, we've looked at the impact that government contracts and professionalisation may have on service delivery to the needy. Well, tonight, I thought we'd have a look at the impact of change on those movements for whom service is part of their rationale, their raison d'être. When community service passes to the professionals and the big end of town, what is left at the grassroots and does it matter? Why volunteer if there's no longer a cause? Can you have the Sallies without soldiers or Vinnie's without volunteers? In a few moments, we'll be joined by a panel from Vinnie's and the Salvos to talk with us about what's happening to community-based service and why it matters. In our second hour, we'll be meeting Paul Martin. Paul's a psychologist and counsellor with a particular concern for the gay community. From his youth as an evangelical Christian, he travelled the difficult journey of coming to terms with his sexual identity, and at one time he became a group leader in the gay exit counselling organisation Exodus. Well, today, Paul Martin encourages an alternative vision of acceptance, understanding, and compassionate pastoral care. Then later in the evening, if we haven't exhausted you, there's more fun. The Inquisition, Noel and the Good Life, Ramadan this week, some music and the chat room, where this evening we'll be joined by Samina Yasmin from the University of Western Australia. And Samina being from Pakistan, I thought we might chat with her about the devastating impact of the floods and perhaps what we can do about them. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. For over 100 years, church-based agencies such as Vinnie's and the Salvos have mobilised their members in the cause of community service. As welfare provision has professionalised, have those volunteer services lost some part of their reason for being? When community service passes to the big end of town, what happens at the grassroots? Well, it's a pleasure to welcome into our studios this evening four people who are going to bring some elements of that discussion to our attention and reflect on why it's important. In our Melbourne studios, welcome to Captain Brendan Noddle of the Salvation Army, who's responsible for the Salvo's services in the inner city area of Melbourne. Brendan, together with David Eldridge. Dave's a retired Salvation Army officer, sometime guest on this program when he was all spangly with his epaulets, now finding his place in the pew as a member of the congregation, but also part of a new group called Collaborative Solutions, working to help churches and charities deal with the difficult business of government relations and contracts. Welcome to you both.
Good evening, John.
Good evening, John.
And in our Adelaide studios, it's a pleasure to welcome from Vinnie's, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, the state president of the South Australian branch, Dominic Lagana. Dominic, welcome to you.
Good evening, John.
And a long-time volunteer, particularly with Vinnie's Youth Services, Ryan Erlandson. Ryan, good to have you with us.
Thanks to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how Vinnie's and the Salvos got started. It seems to me there's a similar ethos, one Catholic, one Protestant, but they spring out of a similar Christian motivation. Dominic or Earl, who wants to take this on? Or Ryan, who wants to take this on first for Vinnie's?
I think we'll leave it to Dominic to lead us off.
Thank you, Ryan. Dominic, Frederick Ozenham, tell us about him. Who was he and what did he do?
Frederick Ozenham was a pretty amazing young man. You have to remember that the society was started over 170 years ago in Paris. At the time, there was great social upheaval.
So this is the 1840s.
Yeah, exactly.
On the back of the 1848 revolution, that sort of stuff.
Yes, yes, spot on. And there was an incredible polarity between rich and poor, the haves and the have-nots. Frederick was attending university at the Sorbonne. In Paris, and he was studying law, and he was involved in muting sessions about his faith, and he realized that arguing about matters of faith was pointless to an extent, and thought, well, I really need to go and demonstrate my beliefs through my actions. And before he turned 21, he established what was referred to as the first Conference of Charity. And we still hold to that conference model today. It's not a conference as in people gathering for a conference, but a group of people who meet regularly on a fortnightly or monthly basis to serve those most in need. And back 170 years ago, that first act of charity was delivering some firewood to some peasants, and they were so scared that they actually just dropped the firewood and ran, and then it basically spread like wildfire throughout the world, and it's still going strong today. In fact, we're establishing our first conference in Nepal later this year.
So wow.
That's the society in a nutshell.
And it's as much about doing service to the poor, that is, doing good, as it is about the spiritual journey of the member.
Yes, the two are completely symbiotic. It's through serving the poor that we find and build our understanding of Christ. So we're completely driven by a sacred cause from that perspective.
David and Brendan, you've heard that. There must be some resonance ringing around there for you. Who wants to take on the sort of that first early spark of the Salvos?
Yeah, I'll do the early spark, if you like, John. I think that there are a lot of similarities. I think William Booth would have been driven more by the evangelical fervour of some Methodist sects of the time. But in 1865, he wanted to reach out into the East End of London and take the gospel to the poor. And I think that initially it was an evangelical organisation, but through social engagement it embraced holistically the needs of people in the East End of London at that time. And I think the organisation's strength, the Salvation Army's strength in its early days, what was its real engagement with the real issues of people's lives. And I sort of think of an analogy. John Rodney Stark, the anthropologist, writing about the second and third century of the Roman Empire, talks about how during the two great plagues in the Roman Empire, the Christian church grew rapidly because Christians served the community during those plagues and the pagan priests fled. And I think the lived compassion of Christian communities in that time furthered their cause more than preaching or the vigorous proselytizing that they'd engaged in. And I think that was true of the earlier Salvation Army, the lived compassion, the embracing community of the organisation, its down-to-earthness with working-class people was what fostered its rapid growth.
Well, let's talk about that and in some ways bring it up to today. We were talking about, Dominic mentioned, Ozenham's engagement by getting people together in groups who through study of the Bible, then went out to work with the poor, or spiritual formation, went to work with the poor. The Salvation Army developed a very practical agency here too. It took on the name of Army and developed a style of membership called soldiership. What was a soldier in the Salvation Army?
It's Brendan here, John. Yep. Soldiership basically was an opportunity for people who had made, they would say, a commitment to Christ and a commitment to live a life in such a way that would emulate the way that he lived his life and the way that he treated others. And it also involved really a countercultural way of living. So Salvation Army soldiers back then and today commit to not drinking alcohol, they commit to not taking drugs, engaging in behaviours that are going to be destructive to them.
They're still ordinary lay people, though. They're not ordained, yes.
No, that's right. And so they often continue in their day-to-day jobs or at university and so forth while continuing to uphold the values of the Salvation Army, but more so the values of Jesus Christ.
And does that involve a sort of an active expression in those early days? So were soldiers engaged in going out and doing good works in the community?
Oh, absolutely. I think prior to World War II, it was really interesting. I think often what happened was people that were just, volunteer or lay Salvationists would actually find themselves involved in teams called the Slum Sisters, or they'd find themselves involved in gutter and garret brigades or drunkard brigades or brothel visitation of all things. And in their own time, in between, you know, being at work and coming home, they'd actually go and be engaged in these visits. And what they did was actually life transforming. It wasn't just filling in time for them or, offering a helping hand to others, but it was actually life transforming for both the people that they engaged with and helped, but also for themselves as well, and it really helped inform their faith as well.
We've got a picture there of organisations almost designed for the time, say from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century. You've got a period that this great social upheaval of the Industrial Revolution in the late 19th century. You come into the 20th century, you've got the First World War, the Great Depression, the Second World War. It's almost as though that century of service there, organisations like Vinnie's and the Salvos were almost hand of God designed for those moments. Dominic, do you ever feel that? There was a real particular match of time and place.
Yeah, yes, I do. I mean, it's I very much see the Salvos as one of the, as probably the other charitable organisation like ourselves that is driven by a sacred cause. They had William Booth, and we had Frederick Osnam. The whole approach of sharing ourselves and who we are and what we have with the poor on a person-to-person basis is obviously intrinsic to both organisations. And I certainly can't claim to understand the workings of God, but there is an amazing spirituality that animates from the earliest times of both organisations.
Well, let's talk for a moment about that spirituality. Ryan, let me bring you into the conversation. What's it like to be a member of St Vinnie's today? What do you do?
Well, I think it's very different to what it has been even just in the last 10, 20 years or the last 10 years that I've certainly been involved. Spirituality, especially for young people, is changing. It's not always about the face of Jesus in the people that we do serve, that each person does bring their own spirituality to the organisation, and it grows from that. We're dealing with clients from often very multicultural backgrounds, so being sensitive to the various faiths, you have to sort of bring your own faith into that, but make sure that you're there representing the society as a volunteer, that you can you can bring that sense of justice and action, that call to action to what you do.
Describe for us practically what your activities in St Vinnie's would be, though, because most people wouldn't have a clue, I would think.
Sure. With the youth conference specifically, we deal with young people between the ages of 6 to 17. The major activities that we do take them on week-long camps out to the outback. I know that that does occur right throughout the country, but speaking specifically from Adelaide, it's then
and this
trying
would
to engage
be,
with...
This would be young people from local church congregations who you'd like to attract to being members of St Vincent Paul?
No, these are disadvantaged
children. Disadvantaged kids, okay.
Have, the majority come through our conference system. So when the members go out to visit a family in need, they might see a child there that, for especially the older kids, may be leading towards drugs, alcohol, skipping school. They feel that this is a way to maybe turned around and see, especially seeing the majority of the volunteers are youths as well, to see a sort of young adult that is a bit more of a role model that they may not have at home.
I'd like to come back to some of that youth stuff a little later.
Certainly.
Dominic, from the point of view of an older person who say, been in a traditional Vinnie's environment for many years, coming out of a local Catholic parish, and says, look, I want to be involved in St Vinnie's, what would they have done? What would the routine have been?
Yeah, probably the best way to explain this is from my own personal experience, and I joined the society at 24, and I'm 39 now, so I'm still relatively young within the society framework. But normally, you would have when there were far greater numbers of people at church, you would normally have people who were maybe part of a local parish, and they would. Think, well, okay, how can I live out my vocation and do more and live out my faith? And then they would maybe, inquire about the society through the local sacristan or someone maybe tapped them on the shoulder. Now that model is changing because.
Before we get on to changing, sure. Whoever gets them and says, look, we've got a little chapter of St Vinnie's operating out of this parish. We want you to come along to our meetings. What would you do at your conference meeting? What happens there? And then how do people get out to meet the poor or whatever it is?
Yes. So you would make the inquiry or you'd be invited to a meeting. And a meeting is normally just a small group of people, as little as three, and it could have as many as 12, and they would, they meet anywhere in the back of a parish hall or a school classroom or throughout Australia. The meetings normally begin with a prayer and spiritual reflection, and there is discussion around that. So there's that opportunity to share our own unique spirituality with each other, and then there's a discussion on the visitations that have taken place, any calls that may have come in through head office, which get distributed to the various conferences, and then
calls would come in to either the parish priest or the conference of St Vinnie's, and depending on your area, if a call for help came from a local area, the call could be passed down to somebody in your group, and would they be assigned to go out and see what the problem was?
Yes, they'd go out in pairs, and we'd get a call from we have a call center. That call center then distributes the calls out to the conferences, and there's normally one person within each conference who's assigned to taking the calls. And they then distribute the calls to members. So it's a very grassroots, networked approach of getting the message out.
And what sort of calls would people be expected to answer, Ryan?
Well, the majority of calls are for that emergency assistance. So assistance with food, furniture, and clothing is sort of the core work that. That our members do. Apart from that, there are many other different ways to be able to assist someone. We feel that we continue with home visits because that's the best way of actually engaging with the clients that need help. We don't have a shop front that they come to. It is about the members really engaging with the family, sitting down. They might offer them a cup of tea or a coffee and have a chat about what it is that that the members can really do to help that family out.
Sounds very much like the early days of the Salvos, as you described them, Brendan.
Yes, it does. And I think some of the things that I mentioned before around Slum Sisters and Gutter and Garret Brigades, they were really about actually going in amongst people that were doing it really tough, you know, living in abject poverty. And actually, in some cases, there were soldiers that lived in those situations as well. So that enabled them to really understand and empathise with where people were at.
So what happens today? Let's talk about things today for the Salvos. We've got a little insight into St Vinny's. What happens with the Salvos today? Dave or Brendan, who wants to take this one up? If you want to become a soldier today, what happens?
Yeah.
And what do you do?
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting question. It varies from place to place. But I think there's been this really interesting movement, particularly amongst young people within the Salvation Army, that have become very, very interested in our roots, as Salvation Army roots. And I think there's been quite a strong comparison between what they read about what the Salvation Army used to do, such as the slum sisters and brothel visitation, and they ask the question, well, why aren't we doing these things today? And I think one of the reasons we don't do them is because a lot of our services have become quite professionalised, which is a good thing. But the question keeps coming up, well, what can I do as a everyday lay salvo, you know,
what is
soldier
there for me to do?
Yeah.
What does soldiership mean today then?
Absolutely. And so here in Melbourne, right in the city, we've noticed that there's incredible need all around the place. And so we've recognised that there's no way that we're going to be able to afford the professional services of people to actually come in and do all the work that needs to be done. And so we've got a real need for people that are prepared to come in and really just get their hands dirty in helping out in practical ways. So it might be preparing meals, it could be going out on our youth bus that goes out at night, or our outreach van. But it's more than just providing a service. There's actually a need for us to address a significant issue, which is evident in Melbourne, but across the nation, which is one of social poverty. So people are very, very lonely, and people are dealing with quite significant issues completely on their own. And so a lot of our soldiers are engaged in building relationships and really doing life with people that are doing it really tough. And it's very interesting, because what we're seeing here in the city goes against the trend of what's happening in some other Salvation Army places. Some people are asking the question about what's the relevance of soldiership today, wearing the uniform, not drinking, not smoking, you know, upholding a whole range of significant values. But in the city here in Melbourne, it's been really interesting, because young people have actually got the opportunity to actually get involved in what the Salvation Army calls its mission, its core mission, which is engaging with the poor and doing life with them and really helping rebuild broken lives. And I mean, we've got a secret weapon as well. We've got General Eva Burrows, who is our recruiting sergeant or recruiting officer in helping people become soldiers, so they don't have much chance to get out of becoming a soldier. I say that jokingly, but what she does an amazing job in recruiting people. And the interesting thing is, we've enrolled 16 people as senior soldiers in the past 2.5 years, and most of those are under the age of 25, which really goes against the trend of what's happening in some other places in the Salvation Army around Australia. So, and we believe that that's because young people are given the opportunity to actually engage in what is our historic mission.
And there's this key of giving people some tangible attachment to the mission is the critical thing for you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, there have been some situations where some of the professional social workers have been a little bit nervous about the engagement of lay salvationists that perhaps aren't qualified social workers in getting involved in helping out those that are doing it tough. But what we've recognised, and I think what a lot of professional social workers working for the Salvation Army have recognised, is there's room for both. So the professionals bring some excellent skills to the table that are absolutely necessary, but the lay salvationists in uniform bring this ability to really do life, particularly outside of business hours, to be available to talk with people, to meet with them, to assist wherever they can, in places and at times that perhaps some of the professional social workers aren't prepared to engage in.
Ryan, just tell me a little bit about young Vinnies today, how you get young people attracted, as Brendan is finding in the inner city of Melbourne. Is it the same thing, that if you show young people that there is a meaningful connection to their own spirituality and the doing of the task, then it's not hard to get them involved? What's young Vinnies
absolutely
about?
Well, we're finding two sides of the coin. There's people that are willing to come in, help out, just put a sausage in a bit of bread, and that's their contribution. They're happy with that. But there are others that are really coming for some meaningful work. There are opportunities. We have many Vinnies involved in schools. We have a presence out in the unis as well to to sort of get the young adults involved as well. And it's through it's mainly through word of mouth and engaging with these young people and spreading the word of, you know, what does Vinnie's do and how do we go about it.
And what attracts them?
I think it's that ground roots approach that they are getting involved, getting their hands dirty, and they can see that benefit that they are providing to the community.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. We're talking with Vinnies and the Salvos about the challenges of those groups today who still see it as part of their mission to be engaged with the poor, but also, most importantly, as part of their own spiritual development. Their membership depends on being involved with service to others. And as has been indicated, as professionalisation takes hold and we become more of a spectator society, is it a challenge to those organisations and movements? On the telephone line now, we've got Phil Cairns. Phil Cairns, a Salvation Army officer who for some years was engaged in the training of Salvation Army officers in Sydney at their Eastern Territory Training College. Phil, welcome to Sunday Night.
Yes, thanks, John.
What for you is the critical nature of being a Salvationist today? From your point of view as somebody who trained people who were becoming Salvation Army officers, this whole idea of soldiership, has it lost its relevance at all? Are more and more people just attending the Salvos as a church, and the whole idea of active soldiership is a bit people struggle with today?
I think there's always a danger where the real meaning of what soldiership or what a membership of a church like the Salvation Army could become. I think there are examples down through history where Christian groups that have started doing charitable work have become purely humanitarian and are just doing the work for the sake of humanity. There's nothing wrong with that, but I suppose if an organisation like the Salvation Army is going to retain, I suppose, the deep meaning for why it does things, it's important to keep our roots strong, our reason, our purpose strong. And I think soldiership and knowing what soldiership is all about is an important part of, I suppose, retaining the real meaning of why we do what we do.
How does it distinguish itself from being just a church member?
I suppose it's a commitment that's involved in soldiership. I think as either Brendan or what was said before, about making commitments not to do certain things, making commitments to Jesus Christ and the positive side of living a life that is totally and completely committed to the example of Jesus Christ. I think that's a key to it, because it means that a person who is determined to become a soldier has to make certain commitments. It makes, I suppose, a commitment to a style of life which is much more rigorous, I suppose, than just attending church on a Sunday and, you know, putting the offering in the plate and doing things like that. So it actually involves committing oneself to various standards, a commitment of their time, a commitment of their giving, a commitment, in fact, of their whole life to the purpose of Jesus Christ. So soldiership is much more than just membership. Soldiership is an activism. It's an activity that takes more than just a Sunday thing.
Dominic, that resonates quite strongly with your earlier description of Ozanam and what he saw the Society of St. Vincent de Paul as being for its members.
Yes, it does, and he's highlighted a good point in his description of the Salvos, which is very similar to what we have with Vinnies. We have Vincenzans, who are people who are part of a conference, and we have volunteers, people who come and help out in a shop or may want to contribute in some way by, as Ryan said, cooking up a barbie to raise some money for the poor. But we have our Vincenzans, and they very much aspire to live out the gospel message by serving Christ in the poor with love, respect, and justice and hope, and living the essential virtues of being a Vincenzan, which and they are simplicity, humility, gentleness, kindness, selflessness, and zeal. So it really is about committing your life to something beyond that of your professional career, and being more sensitive and caring with your family and in your work and in your leisure activities. So there is some points of differentiation between just being a Vincenzo and a volunteer.
Let me ask one other thing, and then I'll get an final observation from Phil Cairns on this. The relationship between your service as a Vincentian or a volunteer, your Christian service, and the idea of, how do I put it, evangelization, if you like, about attracting people into the Christian community. Because Ozanam also was on about that, wasn't he?
He was. But as I said at the start, he was heavily involved in these in these mooting sessions as a person who was studying the law, and we've seen the arguments throughout history. You know, people like Thomas Aquinas in Summa Theologica, you know, argued for faith, and there are plenty of people today like Richard Dawkins, who argue against faith and a belief system based on God, so it's that approach of living out the gospels, and especially I can only obviously comment for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. It's not about being overt and pushing your faith onto someone. It's more so through your actions and through displaying kindness and just doing the ordinary things in an extraordinary way that may cause a person to ask the question, okay, tell me a little bit more about Vinny's, tell me something about Frederick Ozanam. And it really is that sharing of yourself, and that's the Vincenzan approach. It's not one of sort of like overtly telling people how they have to live. In fact, our rule is very clear in stipulating that we are in no way called to judge. There are many government services and departments which make assessments of people. As a Vincenzan, we get the call. It's Christ calling, and we go to serve that person. And it's not our role to judge whether they should be given a voucher for assistance or rental support or anything like that. We are there. We are there to serve.
When I was putting this program together, somebody sent me a quote when I mentioned it to her recently from Pope Benedict, who described it like this: "Charity cannot be used as a means of engaging in proselytism. Love is free. It is not practiced as a way of achieving other ends. But this does not mean that charitable activity must somehow leave God and Christ aside. A Christian knows when it's time to speak of God and when it's better to say nothing and let love alone speak. He knows that God is love and that God's presence is felt at the very time when the only thing we do is love."
Pope Benedict has put that very well.
Phil Cairns, how does that resonate with you?
I think it makes a lot of sense. I'm reminded of Jesus himself, and there's one incident where 10 lepers come to Jesus for healing. And so he heals them, and they go off to the priest. Only one of them comes back and says, "Thank you." Now, I'm sure Jesus would have understood that not all of them were going to respond, but that didn't stop him from healing them. That didn't stop him from reaching out in love. And I suppose the Salvation Army, even though it's an evangelical church, comes from the Wesleyan Arminian background, in which the predominance of God is God of love. Therefore, the service and the reaching out to a suffering world that the Salvation Army does is unconditional. It doesn't matter who that person is, what creed, what colour, anything like that. It's just an unconditional love that we offer. And if doing that, people see the love that we have, people see Jesus Christ in us, that would be our prayer. And very often, those opportunities come just to share our own personal faith. It does take place. But it's not a condition of our service, far from that. And I suppose it's almost what was it, St. Francis of Assisi said, that he was going down to the village to preach, and occasionally he would use words. And I suppose it's that sort of attitude that we have, the fact that our calling to serve the world is a calling of love. And it comes from our love for Jesus Christ.
Phil Cairns, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to switch this conversation around now and have a look at the world that we are presented with. If you'd like to ask some questions from home about some Vinnies or the Salvos, 1300 800 222 is the number to ring. 1300 800 222. Dave Eldridge, I want to talk to you for a moment about the way in which, because you've been mixed up with this over the years. You recently retired after many years as a Salvation Army officer, principally dealing for a lot of your time with government contracts, the professionalisation of welfare services. Now you sit in a congregation where there are potentially all these good people of goodwill, soldiers in the Salvation Army, sitting around and saying, well, what do I do now? You know, all you people have professionalised it. What role is there for me anymore?
John, I used to get paid for doing good things. And now I'm struggling to find out how to be good for nothing, and I think that I'm achieving it well. I think that there is a struggle for people in congregations to find a mission that suits their personality, their skills, and their opportunities. But I think this is the real challenge for the church over the next 50 years, because there are huge challenges facing Australia. Ageing, an ageing community, connecting young people into school and employment, social isolation, homelessness and the housing crisis. These are big issues. We will never be able to fund enough community interventions by professionals to deal with these issues. And if you look at the ageing Australia, you know, we're going to have to face the challenge that the church will have to put its hand up to provide belonging communities, caring places for the growing number of older Australians who won't have a place to belong. And I think that it's certainly true to say that the church population matches the Australian population in its ageing, but there are real ministry opportunities. Now, one of the problems is that I think that governments sometimes want to do volunteerism on the cheap as a substitute for good community, professional community interventions, and that they're necessary. And I latched onto a line that Mr. Abbott said during the campaign. He said, we're not talking about a welfare state, but an opportunity community. Now, I think that's a very good statement. I hope it's not new code for punitive welfare reform. But building an opportunity community requires intentional, strategic, and resource commitments.
Of course, it's being talked about by Cameron in Britain as well.
Absolutely, and I think that the notion of giving people more opportunities to participate, to belong, to get a job, to learn, that's fantastic. It doesn't come for nothing, one. Two, it requires the engagement of the broad community, and the church is a big part of the broad community that can be engaged easily. And I'm just a bit upset by the fact that there hasn't been an effort to either by churches or by government, to engage the church in the big social inclusion challenges of our century.
There's a problem here, though, Ryan and Dominic, I'll get you to comment on this. Is there not, in that so often when that professionalisation of service comes about, the opportunities for the local member are not thought about? It's as though the local member is then redundant.
Mm. It can become an area of concern. But I know with the society that we are conference centric. So
conference means local meeting centric.
Yeah, exactly. And we keep our staff numbers as low as possible, and the employees of the society are there to assist the members. The members aren't paid at the
highest
level.
So it's very much the members being the arms and legs of the society.
Very much, but our rule very much stipulates too, where members haven't got the capacity to provide a particular service, or that service has grown beyond their capacity to provide it in an effective way, then we get people who have the appropriate skills to assist us to ensure that we can continue to provide that service in an effective way. So it's an interdependent relationship between employee and member, and it's collaborative, and it needs to be collaborative for it to be effective. So it's the society, both now and in the future, at the very highest level, the President General level, based in Paris, is a volunteered, down to the grassroots conference member. Vincenzo is also a volunteer.
So it's giving the agency back to the members, in a sense.
It's
a laicization in some ways.
That's exactly what it is. It is a lay group of people. Even so much so that it stipulates in our rule that we're, even though we're a Catholic organisation, we're actually separate from the church. Because it was established by lay people. It wasn't established by the Pope or priests or by a particular order, although we do have the Vincentian Fathers, and that's where we got the name, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, because Frederick Oesnum read the works of St. Vincent and was very much inspired by that mentality of serve the poor with the sweat of your brow and the work of your hands. And
that's a great line.
Yeah, well, that and it's a line that's still very much lived today.
How do you get, Ryan, how do you get young people involved? I noticed when I was looking through, doing some work on this this program, through your website, you've got a Young Vinnies thing. Clearly there is a concern that young people aren't capturing the vision. Now, it's a problem again for the Salvos. I mentioned at the start, both movements seem ideally suited for the 1850s to the 1950s. There's a bit of struggle coming from the latter part of the 20th century into the 21st century about how to keep your feet on the ground and how to attract younger people. What's the trick, Ryan?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the majority of our members come from the parish. This is a bit more difficult to get the young people through the parish as the trend in society is heading.
We're much more a spectator culture, aren't we?
Absolutely. So it's about really getting the message of what Vinnies does out into the public, into the schools, into the universities, and sort of being the face that, you know, this is... people are very social justice oriented and can see the problems in the world, and we really need to engage to say, well, here's something that we're doing about it. You know, is this something that you'd like to help us achieve as well?
Brendan, you mentioned about young people joining your lot in the city. Is that because they see you doing things, that it's an activist thing that appeals to young people? It's they just don't want to be sitting in pews singing songs?
Oh, absolutely. I think we hear discussions from time to time within the Salvation Army that are based on this notion that young people aren't committed anymore. And I think perhaps they're not committed to some of the things that we want them to commit to, which is sitting on the pews and, you know, getting involved in bands and things like that. But when we actually provide them with a really meaningful, cutting-edge opportunity to connect with the poor and to actually do something really meaningful with them, they jump on board. We actually run something called Order 614. So 614 is taken from Isaiah chapter 61, verse 4, that talks about rebuilding, restoring, renewing the devastated ruins of the city. And these young people, there's 12 this year, they live together. We provide the accommodation for them, and then they're involved most days of the week, hands-on, actually working with the poor side by side. And they do that through a variety of avenues. And we give them training, so they do a certificate for an urban mission, but it's not a training program. The training is there to actually undergird their involvement in working with the poor and making a real difference. And we actually see young people flourish in that environment. It's fantastic to see young people putting up their hand, signing on not to do an hour a month, but to actually give up their lives for a year to make really significant difference in the lives of some of the most broken and hurting people around the city.
We've got a final 8 to 10 minutes, and we'll take some calls. Ray in Tweed Heads is on the line. Hello, Ray. Welcome. What would you like to say?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say what a wonderful job places like Vinnie's and other charities do. And in fact, I've donated a lot of things myself. When I resigned from my job, I took all my suits down there. What I'm a little bit concerned about, though, is the problem of accountability. I see a lot of these charities, they spend a fortune putting ads in the paper, Red Shield Day. They must cost $500 a page. And they might collect several million dollars from the public, which I think is public money, and I would like to see a bit more accountability. For example, I don't see Red Shield taking an equivalent page out in the newspapers to let the people know how much they've collected and wherever the money's gone. Take the tsunami, $1 billion we gave to Indonesia. We don't know. Nobody knows where that money's gone. There's been no statement to the taxpayer.
Okay, we'll take that up with Dave. David, your response to Ray.
Gee, thanks, John. I think that most charities get a very concessional rate on a whole lot of things, but I wouldn't deny the fact that there is no mandated transparency, except through things like annual reports, which are quite transparent. You know, the major charities are very accountable in terms of annual reporting and reporting to government departments and all sorts of things like that. But I think there is a danger in Australia that there we have been a little careless generally about the transparency of charities. And I think in some ways the bigger charities are under much more scrutiny than charities that just suddenly appear out of nowhere.
In fact, the Productivity Commission's having a look at this whole area at the moment, isn't it?
And I think that's something that could be looked at. Everyone should be accountable to the same set of priorities. And then I think people, like the gentleman has called him, would be able to feel more comfortable. So, yes, more scrutiny, but I think there's a lot more scrutiny than people think.
Yeah. Ray, thanks for your call. We're going to move on. There's a few calls on the board to Ken in Sandringham. Hello, Ken. Welcome.
Thank you, John. Just wanted to pick up on a couple of quick points, if I may. The Vinnies don't only sort of operate just as conference-based services. I mean, they do an enormous amount of things, you know, relative to the homeless services. I mean, they've got soup vans that go out every night of the week. You know, they've got men's shelters, you know, where they're serving meals and things of that sort. They've got migrant services. They're tutoring English. They've got women's refuges. You know, there's endless things, not just conference-based, you know, and suburban-based activities. So, you know, that's something that's been missed in the discussion so far. But where there is a problem, John, is with the regulatory requirements that some of these services now have to conform to. Food handling practices is one that, you know, comes to the fore. Vehicles having to be, you know...
Maintained,
Yes, and well, but have got to be specialised food carrying vehicles, you know, safety vests for people working on the streets, and you know, there's sort of questions that get raised relative to people that are in that situation, whether they should or shouldn't be wearing them.
Yes. Did this put pressure on all voluntary associations?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and what's the point you want to make out of that?
Well, the point is that. Those regulatory things, I think, affect the way that the services are delivered.
Mm-hmm. They reflect and it puts a greater onus on the delivery of the service, and that makes, in some ways, can inhibit the capacity of ordinary people to get involved.
Well, I think the other thing...
To a degree, but there's also a cost factor in there too,
yes.
John.
Yeah.
John, I think that some agencies have worked out it's a cost factor of between 15 and 33% to meet compliance requirements of government funding in some funding areas. And I think it is getting to a stage where it does need to be streamlined, and I think the Productivity Commission talked about that. And, in fact, the current government were looking at ways of streamlining and working with the major church providers group to look at streamlining reporting arrangements. I mean, everybody's happy with transparency. If they're not, they shouldn't take government money. But I think that ridiculous levels of transparency or ridiculous levels of reporting more openly, small grants are just eating people's time up that could be used for more constructive activity.
Ken, thanks for your call.
Yes.
Going to move on to Rhonda in Cairns. Hello, Rhonda. Welcome.
Good evening.
Yes.
Interesting topic. I think the last callers just touched on a few of the things I was going to say because... I'm a soldier with the Salvation Army.
All right.
And I've found over the last 10 years there's been a lot of the regulations, health and safety, and all the training courses that people need to go through now to be a volunteer. I can see that they're good in some points, but the cost and the time, and sometimes it limits some of the people from volunteering.
Do you think that discourages the organisation as much as it does the people from getting involved in things?
Oh, it doesn't discourage, but it just makes it a bit difficult, that's all. Yeah. Because, you know, as I say, food handling and all that, and some of those courses are quite involved, and someone has to go around and train all the different groups, you know, because we're all over Australia. And being up in the far north, you know, people come up and we all travel to either at one centre point or whatever to do our training courses and to get our uniforms and all that sort of thing.
Rhonda, thanks for your observation. Challenges for the present. Where do you see the most exciting opportunities for you, Ryan?
I think it's just in expanding Vinnie's, whether it be youth or otherwise, into some of the other areas of the community. We've moved into housing, into mental health, and really picking up on the issues of society today.
And you're winning more people to the movement, are young people more active and more interested?
Absolutely. There are more people that are willing to volunteer. I think the stats out that there are more people willing to volunteer but giving less hours. So it's about trying to work with that and working with people's time to try and use it as best we can.
Got to be more flexible with our time. Briefly, Brendan, 30 seconds.
I think we're really committed to the idea of making Melbourne a better place and doing that in partnership with others. And we want to be right at the cutting edge of some of the current social issues that are happening, such as binge drinking, knife crime, homelessness, and really continuing to make a significant difference with our soldiery.
There you are, folks. If you want to get involved, Salvos and St Vinny's, good examples of people who not only do good for the poor, but help you improve your life. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.